and welcome to the Business of Sustainability podcast, the latest show in partnership with Future Plus and City AM. My name is Alex Smith, and I'm joined by my co-host and fellow founder of Future Plus, Mike Penrose. Powered by data and guided by human expertise, Future Plus is an award-winning sustainability and ESG management and reporting platform that empowers companies, investors, and asset managers of all sizes to understand, measure, evidence, improve, and report on their sustainability impact and goals. If you'd like to find out more about Future Plus, look out for details at the end of this podcast. I'm delighted to introduce our excellent guest for today's show, Jo Patterson, Managing Director of Zeno London. Thank you for joining us, Jo. If you could give us a little bit of intro, a little bit of your background, what it is you do, how you got there, that would be fantastic.
Sure. So thank you for having me. Yeah, I am the MD of Zeno London. We're part of a global communications network. We're the London and European hub. A lot of our offices are based in the US. We plan and activate comms campaigns for a host of clients across a host of sectors in the brand sector, healthcare, technology, digital and social, all the type of stuff that people are consuming daily for a host of brands that many of whom you will have heard of. A lot of our work is around corporate reputation. A lot of it does bleed into ESG and sustainability, so I'm particularly happy to be here today. Not an expert, though, as I said to you guys, so no difficult science questions, please. And we are about 75-80 people strong. We're based in Old Street, and there are about four or five permanent dogs that come into my office as well. And I was saying earlier, I sort of wrangle or try to wrangle a group of very talented, committed, creative people on a daily basis and do my best to sort of maintain order. So that's me.
Amazing. Well, we'll only do a sort of multi-question quiz at the end on sustainability and radiation forcing for carbon.
Excellent. Science-based targets.
Excellent.
Brilliant. In this episode, we're going to be exploring Zeno's mission, objectives, and what sets them apart from competitors in terms of how they value sustainability. And for the first question, I'll hand over to you, Mike.
Thanks. Jo, it's in your annual report, you have put sustainability really quite central to what you do. You elaborate a lot on why it's important to you. But where does that come from in the business? What's the motivation behind putting sustainability central to your annual report and how you communicate about yourself?
Sure. I think there are three main reasons, and they're all very different. The first is that we, as I mentioned, advise clients on sustainability strategy. And about 2-3 years ago, we realized that we weren't necessarily following our own advice. And the notion of being accountable and creating an ESG report for the agency was something that very few, as far as we are aware, had actually done. So there was a bit of a case of physician heal thyself, that the sense that if you're advising clients to do X, you also have to do X and be accountable for your actions and the progress and the ambitions that you have in the space. So that was really point one, and that was driven by the US. And we've got a really smart team of ESG and sustainability experts who were able to deal with the complexity and the language and the sheer hard work of doing that. The second point, we were talking about it earlier, I think, is around our people. We are a really young industry. The average age in my office is about 26, 27. And as an industry generally, it's very youthful. And a lot of the people that I work with have grown up being much more environmentally aware in all sorts of ways than my generation ever was. And so we have to embed the philosophy of sustainability in our ethos, really, because it's expected, it's table stakes. And if we didn't, I think we would be dinged and I think we would be questioned quite significantly and quite rightly. And the third reason is probably more a commercial and business oriented reason, because again, there is so much scrutiny in the space that our clients are really looking for partners who uphold and mirror their values and have the same degree of commitment to ESG generally. So, and that often manifests in questions that we are asked at the beginning of any of our pitch processes, for example, what is your point of view on X, Y, or Z? And I think we might talk about this a little bit later. So you have to be able to show up in the right way for clients to feel that you understand the space from a consultative point of view, but from a human point of view, you share the same ambitions and goals. So three main reasons, I would say.
Within that, it's I think the really interesting thing developing at the moment, where we were talking about it a little bit earlier, where ESG and sustainability used to be seen, I think, primarily as a comms tool, as you were sort of alluding to there, that the younger generation want it, so we're going to talk about it, but not necessarily part of core business. Mm. Are you finding with your clients now that's bleeding through in terms of having more more things you can represent as being tangibly sustainable within communications, as opposed to please make us look green, if you know what I mean.
Yes, no, completely. Yeah. The whole greenwashing or absolutely, greenwashing debate. I think wise clients understand that you have to follow through on the things you say you're going to do. And it's particularly pointed right now because a lot of the commitments that big corporates made, thinking Unilever in particular, you're coming up to the years with five or zero when it becomes very, very pointed because you tend to set those targets with a five or a zero, 10, 15, 20 years down the line. And the acknowledgement that action now is critical is key because there is nowhere to hide. And if you don't act, you are basically creating a void. And is it nature abhors a vacuum?
Yes,
is that
absolutely.
The phrase?
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
We know what happens to voids and vacuums. They get filled with all sorts of stuff that then you lose control of. So I think wise clients understand that you have to demonstrate and proof point what it is you're doing, that you can't just talk about it anymore because that you can just scratch the surface of that. That's very, very, those days are gone. But the flip side of that is that if you are making commitments that are too big or too impossible, you then get dinged because you're not hitting your commitments and targets. And I think Unilever is a case in point. And them coming out and being brave and acknowledging that, for example, some of their plastic commitments, they just weren't going to hit because of changes in the sort of systems that enable them to hit them or not have impacted what they can do. So the basic rule of thumb with any aspect of this, the same way in life, is honesty is the best policy. Because if you're dishonest, it will come and bite you at some stage.
It's within that, what you said there is almost exactly this conversation we have a lot with clients, which is we did a really interesting sociological study at the beginning that realised if you go out and tell people, I'm good, and this is why sometimes on this podcast before I've rallied against the things that are just badges that go, you know, I'm a great company. If you come out and get it, the reflex of most people is to try and scratch away and to find what's wrong. If you come out and we found it and say, look, none of us are perfect, we know we're not perfect, but we know what we want to do, we want to get better, people tend to go, well, okay, fair enough, they're being honest with us. And so you're saying you're seeing that now flow through in the sort of way communications is being handled by with the bigger clients.
Yeah, completely. I think people are more forgiving if you A, are honest, B, admit your successes, but also your struggles and your failures, and then see what you're going to do about it. Again, it's pretty sort of common sense stuff, this, but because we have been brought up in a corporate and political culture of obfuscation for many, many years, hiding or either saying nothing or over-exaggerating was the sort of, you know, the recognised strategy. But now that is absolutely folly. So just be honest.
I think we recognise a lot of the communications that were coming out were ambitious because people wanted to be ambitious, but it wasn't achievable ambition.
Yeah.
They wanted to do well, but had no intelligence or data to how they were going to do that. And they didn't have those underpinning sort of foundations and framework in order to say, actually, progress is most important. And I think there's always been a fear of people telling the truth. But we're finding with regulation as well that that is where that is heading. So don't just tell us what you do, tell us what you can't do or you aren't doing. And we're seeing that sort of trend for businesses to be more open and to admit where there's potential issues. There's been some fantastic brands that have done so, I think. Tony's Chocolonely's and Oatly, I think, have had to very much come out with that sort of messaging of, we're trying, but we're not quite getting there. But this is our new plan, and I think that's okay as well. It's a very human response.
Completely. Rather than blustering your way through it and then getting caught out, that's when things reputationally can go awry. So if it's not working, figure out why it's not and how you're going to fix it. Again, there's a huge degree of common sense in this, but the sort of sense that we have to be perpetually perfect all the time permeates corporate culture. And admitting that things are going wrong is not a sign of weakness. It's a sign of complete strength and acknowledgement.
I think the last government probably could have learned lessons from that one as well.
Yes. Let's not go there, Mike.
Taking all that into account and how businesses should be looking at sustainability and communicating it, how do you bring that in-house into Zeno? So you say you've got this incredibly youthful workforce, they're quite engaged with the subject, but how do you actually bring that into what that means for Zeno and sort of propel that forward?
Yeah, we are, as you say, about 80 people from many different walks of life. And the first thing when we started sort of putting sustainability at the heart of the agency that I grappled with, and I'm a words person, I've got a degree in English, was that just the language and the obfuscation around the language. It's quite difficult, it's quite scary. So demystifying the whole subject in as many ways as we can is really important. When you think about SDGs and carbon offsetting and greenhouse gases and all of the science that goes with it, most people in comms aren't scientists. They tend to come from an arts and humanities background, and data can be a bit of a scary word for us. So just sort of taking some of the fear away from the language is step one. And then applying it to the business in ways that make sense, because we're not a manufacturing business. We don't make bottles or plastic or whatever. And so you have to take the topic and make it relatable and understandable to what we do. And it manifests in all sorts of small ways. So making small incremental changes in the business rather than trying to boil the ocean. So it's things like the food that we buy. You know, we're a very hospitable industry. We eat and drink a lot. Where's it coming from? Our energy sources, our waste, our technology. We're very technologically driven and use a lot of kit. What are we doing with that? And then what do we do with it at the end of its life cycle? How do we... we moved offices a couple of years ago, and I asked my office manager to deck out all of our outside space with upcycled and recycled furniture, which she was horrified by because it meant she had to work twice as hard to do it. But it's small things like that in an office-based environment that I think are sort of, they add up cumulatively to reinforce what it is you're trying to do. I think the second hurdle, though, is you do need a degree of understanding. I'm fortunate because I can ask the idiot questions. And I do have a team of people who are more steeped in ESG than I am, who will guide me when I'm asking the idiot questions. So you do need to understand the basics, I think, to be able to have an idea of the direction of travel. The most important thing, though, when you're dealing with 80 people under the age of 30 is to make it fun. Because if you make it very dry and like going to a lecture and, right, today we're going to talk to you about turning the lights off, A, it's patronising, and B, they'll look out the window within 30 seconds. So we try to find ways to make the educational aspect of what we're doing as exciting and interesting as possible. So, for example, about 6 months ago, we did our own version of Vinted. They're at the app where you can go and buy vintage clothing. My 17-year-old daughter gets all of her kit from there, so I'm learning from her and then apply that learning at work. People brought in their secondhand clothes. We set up a rail in the office, and then they bid for how much they thought it was worth. We made about 500 quid. But the whole point of it was a Trojan horse to talk about fast fashion, recyclability, landfill, all that sort of stuff. And then the team, you know, put sort of notices and sort of information and education around the office for the week. So it was a really small but smart way of bringing people with you on the journey. That's really important, because if it's didactic and, as I say, lecturey, it's not going to work.
There was a brilliant, an interesting blog post a little while ago that said one of the issues with climate change and sustainability was that scientists had tried to tell us what we needed to do. And the issue had been that there hadn't been a comms channel that had made it fun and that had made it accessible and had made it feel like people's problems or people's issues or challenge or opportunity to deal with. And for so long, it had come directly from scientists, and it missed this communications piece where people went, actually, this is how people want to hear it, and this is what they need to hear, and this is how that, you know, this is the method in which we need to communicate it. And I think we're getting better at that now. I think scientists are also getting, we always have the conversation about head and heart, and I think there is that beautiful connection between of understanding why, but being able to communicate and then being heard.
Yeah, completely.
And I think that's a really key piece in the communications world at the moment, is translating it as honestly as possible.
Yeah.
I think it's linked to that, where your industry plays such a critical role as well. It's interesting to hear how you do it internally, because I then imagine that's the challenge externally. Is, you know, I come from the not-for-profit world, and I think they have been spectacularly bad at creating cause-related campaigns because they immediately default to the scientific. Government should change this policy, which will have this effect at the UN, blah, which loses the attention of about 98% of the population within seconds. And I think it's a really interesting way of gauging. Do you find that the way you are, not in any pejorative sense, simplifying the message internally is then playing out into more effective messages externally?
There's two tracks here. There's our own internal desire to be a better business, And then externally for us, obviously there's the work we do for our clients. Yeah. For us, externally talking about this often, I think, can be a little bit self-serving because we are in a very competitive industry.
Yeah.
And every agency is always looking for a USP around anything. Mm. Because it gives you something to talk about, and you can go out and write award entries and feel good about it. And so we tend not to talk about what we're doing that much externally. I mean, I have submitted for a couple of awards, but that's not really why we're doing it. The main benefit, I think, of doing it is around our employees feeling like the business is reflecting again their values. Yeah. So we do, it's more of an internal engagement piece mm-hmm. than anything for us. But one of the reasons why I wanted to talk to you guys today was the whole challenge for agencies when you are running at such a pace is finding the time to do things yeah. like this. And when I came across you guys and Future Plus, it was such a much more accessible way for us to access all of the sustainability improvements that we wanted to make versus B Corp, which is lauded as the thing that everybody must do. And we looked at B Corp as part of the global network. It's much more difficult to do if you're part of a network because every piece of infrastructure yeah. is checked and balanced. And what I was looking for was something that was more flexible for us, which is why the platform was so helpful. So it's not really answering your question, I think, Mike, but we tend to use it as an internal motivation rather than an external approbation, if that makes sense.
No, I think you've answered the question very well. As again, if you are reflecting values internally, those values will permeate
yes.
out,
yes.
I think. And it was interesting you're saying about, was what I was saying earlier about badges that demonstrate that you are good but have no detail or for want of a better word, communicable substance behind them other than this badge means you're good. I find in society now just generates cynicism.
Yes.
Whereas, a very simple, broken down way of saying this is what we want to do, this is where we're going, this is our direction of travel, I find then permeates out and generates what we were talking about earlier, that trust. People trust, I'm human, I'm honest, this is what we want to do, far more than they trust we're great, follow us.
Yeah.
because that just yeah. that doesn't tell you anything.
And particularly in our industry, I think for many people still have a slightly outdated perception of what we do. If you've watched The Thick of It, it's either
yes.
spin or again obfuscation or telling lies. It's not. We tell the truth. Obviously, we tell the truth in a way that is advantageous to our clients. That's why we're paid to do what we do. But the notion of badging or very thinly veiled performance is what, again, apropos of what we were saying earlier, gets you into trouble. So I'm really, really candid about where we hit our marks and where we don't when we talk about this stuff.
Internally, you talk about your 24 for 24 program.
Yeah.
Elaborate a little bit more on what that is and why you do it.
So you folks actually should take a lot of credit for this because the reason why this came about for us as an agency, we do these things called RFIs and RFPs, requests for information, requests for proposals. And they're normally sort of very dry spreadsheets and you have to answer a load of questions before you're even considered to go forward for a pitch. And there was an RFI that asked us for our sustainability credentials. What are you doing as a business? And I turned to my new business partner and said, Waggers, her name is Rebecca Wagstaff, what are we doing? And she said, water-saving loos, which is a true story. And I looked at her and said, come on, that we've got to be better than that. And so it started from there. And when we came across the Sustainability Group and Future Plus, what it enabled me to do, once I got over the sort of slight scariness of, gosh, there are 250 indicators or whatever it is that I need to look at, again, scary language. But when you dig into it, what it did for us was surface what we could prioritise, because again, we're not a manufacturing business, we're a service industry, but there were certain elements of the initial analysis that weren't as pertinent for us, but absolutely were. And because it operates across those five sectors, we were already quite active in the DE&I space, for example, mm-hmm. and the social space, less so in environment, less so in climate. So it enabled me to surface the priorities, and that became, it was actually 22 for 22, We're now at 24 for 24. The danger is we'll get to 45 for 45 and it will never stop. But it became a way of, as I say, servicing those 22, now 24 priorities, that they're the things that we publish. It's on our website. That's what we report against when we come together in agency meetings. And we tick some of them off every year. Some of them carry forward and we put new ones in as we achieve some of the things we want to do. But that is, to your point about simplification, if I'd have tried to take the agency through the entire platform, I would have lost them within 30 seconds. Yeah. By distilling it down into simple, tangible, and not all of them are simple, some of them are more ambitious, but things like committing to meat-free catering, for example. And that created issues. And some of our clients were, well, I want a chicken sandwich. And I'm, well, sorry, there's a Greggs, go and get steak bake. Yeah. I didn't say that, obviously. It was slightly more polite.
Only internally.
Yeah, exactly. My inner monologue was saying that. And to be fair, most of our clients have been absolutely, completely understanding and get it. But it is those small increments, again, that make a difference. But that's what it is. It's our plan. And we are about halfway through the plan at the moment. Obviously, it runs calendar year. And we're about to report the halfway stage in a couple of weeks' time.
Look forward to that.
And have you found that is helping with RFIs and RFPs now? Okay. Not just the engagement, but actually now we're getting business and we're able to prove that we are operating
completely. Completely. I have, from going from water saving loos, I now have a host of evidence that enables us to answer those questions robustly and authentically as well. Mm-hmm. I don't have to scratch around anymore. There's so much now that we can speak to. So yes, it's helped solve the problem for me as well.
You talked a lot earlier about how, you know, your clients are wanting to represent things that are sustainable and very convincingly just now about how understanding it internally allows you to communicate it better. Given all this work you've done, what advice would you have either for other communications companies but also for clients in other businesses on how you do this effectively?
I think for the communications agencies, or in fact any small business, we're, you know, less than 100 people who wants to be better at this. That's what it boils down to, being better. And this is not a plug for you guys, although it blatantly is. It was enormously helpful for me because the B Corp challenge, I didn't know where else to go. Mm-hmm. And then when I found the platform, it just gave me a much more intuitive, flexible way to put this at the heart of the business, because it's about continuous improvement rather than sort of a massive pylon that you sort of do and blitz for a year and then you sit back for 2 or 3 years until you have to get the accreditation again. It holds you to account regularly. And that works for us because we've got a day job to do as well. And so we tend to, I look at our figures and when, if the numbers start to sort of, if that little line starts to go down, that's when we go, right, guys, come on, we've got to. So we found a way to make it work for us, you know, a small team of people trying to administer it with everything that goes with it. I would say to any comms agency or small business, look at the platform because we found it incredibly helpful. I've come on to this podcast to talk about it because I don't want it to be something that we hold on to as a USP. It's much more important than that. So any agency who's scratching their heads around this, look at the platform because it will really, really help. You can give me the fiver later. But I absolutely.
And a glass of wine.
Yeah. This is our third or fourth year, I think, of working with you guys now. And yeah, it really absolutely has been a huge galvaniser for the business in so many ways. From a consultancy and client point of view, I mean, we touched on it earlier. I think the tendency, and we talked about this as well, at difficult economic times is to sort of go back and stick to the knitting. And we can see that in the ebb and flow of the briefs and the work that we're given. It's much more at the moment around corporate stability, strong leadership, navigating, you know, changing regulation as we've got a new government to grapple with. 2 or 3 years ago, ESG was absolutely at the top of our list of client demands, I would say. So the economic circumstances of the nation absolutely impact how corporates show up. And the danger is when you step away from those commitments, you do create those voids, and voids and vacuums are filled with negativity, particularly on social media, and you lose control of the narrative. So for me, I would... And of course, all comms agencies are going to say this, but do the opposite of what you're probably thinking is the right thing to do. Lean into it more, but lean into it with honesty and humanity. I think you can bring your employees with you on a journey. As a big corporate as well, employees can be hugely powerful advocates. It's the part of the comms puzzle that is underutilised. I think employee engagement, the technical phrase that we use, is absolutely now much higher up the comms hierarchy. But if you can't convince the people that you who work with you and for you, how are you going to convince those who don't? And so focusing on internal engagement, I think, is really important. I think moving forward, partnerships, allyships, doing this alone is impossible. I think brave CEOs, CMOs, and organisations will come together to solve problems rather than standing alone as isolated bastions. There's a really good event that happens every year called Anthropy. I don't know if you guys have been there, mm-hmm. which is designed to sort of help solve the UK's problems. I'm simplifying mm-hmm. it, but that's what's at its heart. That happens at the Eden Project every year. Yeah. And it brings together NGOs and charities, state and business, to try to solve problems together. So breaking down silos is really key, and also investing in the people that you need to do it. It is not a CEO job, it is not an MD job, as I find out every day as I grapple with this stuff. You need to actually have the expertise embedded in your business at C-suite level. Mm-hmm. Don't subcontract it or make it less important. It is as important as the numbers, as the people, as the marketing and your external sort of reputation. So get the right people around the highest tables would be my advice.
And I think one of the things we talk about a lot is inherent or integral to what you're talking about there is where our industry has got it wrong is sanctimony. It's telling people they should do good for good's sake.
Yeah.
We're finding, I think what you've really expressed really well there is actually you can very quickly boil that down to numbers, becoming more efficient, becoming more effective, becoming more motivated.
Yes.
These are all bottom line issues.
Yes.
And I think the big shift will be in this industry when we move away from do-gooding, so to speak. Nothing wrong with wanting to be good, but when all the pressures are on financial returns, performance, when your investors are on your back, when your owners are on your back, being able to say this relates to the bottom line in these ways, which it very clearly does, I think is when we'll shift sustainability from being an additional thing to, like accounting in the 70s or things like, in accounting in the 70s, everyone was saying, oh, we couldn't possibly do all of these particular things, all this accountability, until you found out that the analytical tools had a direct effect on the bottom line. Mm. And then it became, the centre, the CFO became the right hand of the CEO.
Mm-hmm.
Now I think if we can boil it down to the bottom line and communicate it in the way you've just expressed, is where we'll probably mainstream sustainability and it'll become part of everybody's business.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, if you're a CEO or running a business, you are there to deliver a return.
Exactly.
But their financial return goes hand in hand with reputational return.
Yeah.
And I think I don't like the phrase, and you touched on this earlier as well, that like doing good for doing good's sake. But certainly in my generation, mm-hmm. We were less concerned with that. It was more about accumulation. I mm-hmm. have a 17-year-old daughter, a 19-year-old son, and they scrutinise what the brands that they respect really do. So you can't get away with this not being at the top table for much longer. But at the same time, don't big it up if you can't back it up.
Yeah.
Authenticity.
Yeah.
Completely.
And Gordon Gekko is gone.
Yes.
Something from our generation as
yes.
well.
So. Completely. And isn't that a good thing?
Yeah, very much so. I think, unfortunately, that's all we've got time for. But thank you, Jo, for joining us today. If you'd like to join the conversation, please leave comments or questions in the comments section at the bottom or email us at info@future-plus.co.uk. Please remember to hit the subscribe button for future episodes. And if you'd like to find more about Future Plus or Zeno, please visit the links in the description.